And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Chris Wallace hardly needs an introduction. He's been a presence in American journalism now for more than four decades. And as the host of Fox News Sunday, he famously tangles with public figures every week. I had an interesting chat with Chris recently at the Fox News headquarters in Washington. Chris Wallace, thank you so much for being here. We've had many encounters over microphones and cameras, but it's great to sit down with you.
We've never done it this way, where you're asking the questions and I have to
I know, and I'm not going to give you the same admonition I always got from you to keep my answer short, because it's a podcast, man. You can expand.
Well, no, we should tell that story. So I give every person, not you, everybody I interview, I always at the very end, because we only have 12 minutes, and I always say, or 10 minutes, I always say, now look, try to keep your answers short so we can cover more territory. And I had said that to you so often, and you're the only person in 13 years of this show who has ever done it. Before I was going to get it out one day, you said, now, Chris, keep your question short and we'll be able to cover more territory. And I laughed the way you did.
Yeah, which you didn't, by the way. But anyway.
Yes, okay.
You come by journalism naturally, but not in the way people suspect, because everyone knows you're Mike Wallace's son. But you didn't really know him until later in life.
No, that's true. I knew him, I did.
But knew him in that way.
But really close, no. Not probably till I was a teenager. But actually, Chicago figures into this, because when I was about 4 years old, the Democratic Convention, 1952, the Adlai Stevenson Convention was being held in Chicago, and I lived on North State Parkway. And Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic nominee, was staying in the McCormick Mansion right around the block. And my mother, who'd been divorced for a number of years, there's no scandal here, from my father, was watching on TV and saw this dreamy man, as she described him, who was reporting from Stevenson headquarters, black and white TV. This was back in 1952.
Yes.
And she said, well, so, Chris, let's go and see the excitement. So I remember I got on my tricycle, and she walked over, and I didn't know this until years later, put on a somewhat revealing sundress, and we went around the block, and there was Bill Leonard, who was a correspondent for CBS News, ended up becoming the president of CBS News, and in fact, my father's boss. So he was really the one I grew up with. I was nine when they got married, and he was really the most influential figure in my life and career.
You and your mom was in had a background in journalism as well. Is that right?
No, not really. But just as a cute story, so my mother and father met at the University of Michigan. He graduated. She quit after her sophomore year, and he went to work for a radio station in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And as one of the things, he had been a disc jockey and an announcer and things like that. He'd never done any journalism. He had to start interviewing people. The first questions that Mike Wallace ever wrote to ask people were written by my mother, because he didn't know how to write a question.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's true.
So you actually were brought together. And tell me if I get I know you'll correct my facts. You always do.
As you have with me.
You reconcile with your father as a teenager, really as in part because of tragic circumstances.
Yes, that's true. I was about 14 years old, and my brother, Peter, was 5 years older than me. He was in between his sophomore and junior years at Yale. He went off for the summer to Europe, as college kids do, and in just a horrible, tragic accident, was climbing up a mountain in Greece, and not a mountain is a kind of an overstatement, but it was big enough, slipped and fell and died. And I think at that point, as I say, I was 14, my father and I both felt we ought to get to know each other, and we did. And he used to take me, because it wasn't that I disliked him, it's that I didn't know him. And it was a little bit like being forced to spend time with an uncle that you don't really know, but you know, your folks say you're supposed to go see. So he would take me. There was this great watering hole in New York City called Toot Shore.
Yeah, very famous.
And he was a big, fat. He was almost like Jackie Gleason. He was a big, heavy set, loud talking guy, and it was the big watering hole for sports figures.
Yeah, right.
And my father knew that I loved sports, so really more to see the sports figures than to see him. He'd invite me out to Toot Shore, and I would happily go. And because he was famous, I can remember meeting Frank Gifford and Howard Cosell and Eddie Arcaro, who was a famous jockey that I'm sure none of your listeners know who he was. And but in any case, and in addition to all of that and a good meal, we got to know each other, and it slowly developed over time. The most interesting part of the story is, so now fast forward to I'm in my 40s, and I split up from my first wife. And my stepfather had just died, and I think my father always felt he was a little bit excess baggage with my father, which I didn't feel that way, but I think he did. But in any case, I was kind of adrift, you know, divorced. Well, if there's one thing my father knew, it was divorce, because he was married four times. And so I was working in a primetime magazine, traveling all over the country and the world, and so was he, obviously, on 60 Minutes. And for, I would say, 2 to 3 months, every night, David, every night, he would find where I was and call me to say, how you doing? And
that's nice.
That really cemented it. And I would say for the last 20 to 25 years of his life, we were best friends.
That's really moving. Did you and he very famously grappled with depression. So did you find yourself playing the same role for him at times?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, look, it's a special relationship, and in a business like this, which is very competitive and sharp elbows, and everybody's got an agenda, we would critique each other, and we both knew that the only thing that the other one wanted was that to make you as good as you could possibly be. So, sure, we talked about that. It's funny you mentioned this about depression. I was talking with my wife just last night, and something came up about depression. I say, well, fortunately, that was one thing I have not inherited from my father. But he did suffer from depression. And interestingly enough, by sort of later in his career, I think he was as proud of the role he had in the early 80s in destigmatizing depression as anything he did. Here was this big, tough, capable guy, Mike Wallace, and he was suffering. And this was back in the 80s when depression wasn't as widely known and as accepted as it was. There was a stigma about it, and he was very public and one of the first public figures to go public about it. And I think he felt
very
really proud of that.
Really important. I have to tell you that I was one of those people who was moved by that, because my dad committed suicide when I was young. And I kept it very, very quiet for a very long time.
There was a stigma.
You know, yeah. I mean, and I realized the reason people commit suicide and don't get the help they need is because of the stigma, and it causes them not to come forward. So I started writing about it, talking about it, and I've never gotten more reaction to anything I've ever done than those kinds of pieces or talks, because there's so many people who just want to know that it's okay to acknowledge that you have what is an illness, and that you can, it's okay to go and ask for help.
Absolutely.
So what your dad did was heroic, really.
I'll tell you a quick interesting story about that. There was a show that Bob Costas used to do called Later, and it was on really in the middle of the night. It was on after Johnny Carson and after whatever followed Johnny Carson. This was on about 2 a.m. And my father went on it, and Costas started asking him about depression. And my father said, you know, it's really important that we talk about this now at 2 a.m, which is when people were watching it, not when it was taped, because he said, if you're suffering from depression, one of the key things is you can't sleep, and you're up in the middle of the night, and you're feeling alone and adrift, and they're probably listening to us and watching us right now who are suffering from this, and so it's important that we talk to them.
Yeah, I'm sure he was right. There's something about the night that's particularly oppressive. You know, I'm I've always been interested in fathers, famous fathers and sons who go into the same field, particularly as it relates to politics. I mean, you know, Al Gore Sr. and Al Gore Jr. and you know, just obviously the Romneys and others. And wondering what it's like for the younger person in that relationship who's in the same field. Your father was a giant in broadcasting. You've achieved the same heights in your own way. But coming up as a young man in the business, how difficult was that? Were expectations higher, do you think? And was there a concern that people thought, well, he's here because he's the great man's son?
I want to put this in context, because let's be honest. You know, they talk about problems being like rich people's problems, you know, not problems of life and death. And this is very much...
It's a high-class problem.
It's a high-class problem. Yeah. Rich is the wrong thing. So you know, to sit there and say, woe is me, I was the son of Mike Wallace, I'm not sure I'm going to get a lot of sympathy from people out there. But to anybody who's been in that position, yeah. It is, and it doesn't have to do just with politics or showbiz. It could do with anything. My guess is, you know, if you were the son of the big lawyer in town or the guy who owned the hardware store in town, it would be true. To be the son of or the daughter of is its own, as I say, not oppressive, but it's a burden. And you're exactly right. People question why you're there, whether you got it because of your connections or because of your talent. You know, I suppose it's worse if your father is a public figure as opposed to my hardware right. salesman example, because everybody knows him, and to the degree that you're in the same business, everybody kind of knows you. I can tell you that there's a long period of time where people, even people that you've worked with a long time, will suddenly say Mike instead of Chris, and that always cuts a little bit because you think, well, gosh, I've been working this with this guy for 5 years, and he still thinks of me as Mike Wallace's son subconsciously. But, you know, it's interesting. I'd say two things about it, that at some point, and it took a while, maybe it was in my 40s, that I finally came to this conclusion. I said, you know what? I am never going to be Mike Wallace. But then I said, neither is anybody else. And there's a heck of a lot of room to have a great career and accomplish a lot and, you know, and not have it be in comparison to anybody. The other thing I would say, and I find this really quite surprising because it was always there, is that after my father died, and particularly now that he's been gone almost five years in April, I almost feel like I have to carry the banner for him. I want people to remember him. And where before, if somebody said something about your father or even called me Mike, and I might get a little bit ruffled by it, now my reaction is I'm glad you still think of him and you still remember him.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to your I want to pick up the narrative of your story because one of the things that interested me is I read somewhere that you attended the 64 Republican convention in San Francisco, which is like a legendary political event. Some would say some of the roots of what we're dealing with today in our politics flowed right from that campaign and that convention, and beyond which you were like an intern for the biggest legend in broadcasting, Walter Cronkite.
That's all true.
Now, this is probably the upside of the high-class problem,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So in those days, and they don't do it today, and they should. They used to, you know, is it blatant nepotism? Yes. But what they used to do is the networks, and it wasn't just CBS, if you were the son or daughter of a top correspondent or an executive, you would get a job working at the conventions, and the thought being, one, these people were probably pretty bright and could help, and secondly, because they'd get an insight into what their mom or dad did all the time. So I was working there with, you know, the son of Richard C. Hodlett and with Walter Cronkite's daughter, and I'll get to that story in a moment.
Yes.
But I was the gopher, and this was much more because my stepfather was the head of the CBS election unit than because of my father. I was the gopher, gopher coffees, gopher pencils, etc., in the anchor booth with Walter Cronkite, And Eric Severide at the Goldwater Convention at the Cow Palace outside San Francisco in 1964. And a little piece of trivia is who was the only person that was in both anchor booths, both the Democratic in Atlantic City, Lyndon Johnson, and the Republican in the Cow Palace, Barry Goldwater. And the answer is 16-year-old Chris Wallace, because if you may remember, between those conventions, Walter Cronkite got fired because the ratings were low, and Bill Paley kicked him out. So they put this combination of Roger Mudd, who was in his 30s, and Robert Trout, who was in his 70s, together. And the only person who survived from one anchor booth to the next was me.
And you said you were going to tell the story about Cronkite's daughter. I guess she became a special friend of yours for a while. Huh?
Well, she was my first girlfriend, Nancy Cronkite, who I hasten to add was a lot better looking than Walter and didn't have a mustache. I have to say, people at CBS were tickled pink. I remember answering the phone in the newsroom one day, and one of the CBS reporters said, "Is this Nancy Cronkite's boyfriend?" And I laughed, and I said, you guys are all enjoying this. Well, because at the time my father was anchoring the CBS Morning News and Cronkite was anchoring the CBS Evening News, and they said it was like the merging of two duchies or something like that.
Do you remember the actual convention itself the drama there?
Oh, sure.
I mean, Rockefeller being booed,
yes,
and Scranton walking out and all of that stuff.
And Dwight Eisenhower talking about sensation-seeking columnists and commentators, and people started shaking the platform of the foundation of the anchor booth that we were in. So, yeah, and I remember Barry Goldwater's moderation in the pursuit of liberty is no virtue and extremism, whatever.
Yeah. Do you ever think about that today as we're watching what's going on? I mean, do you see lineage between sort of the movement that was there at that convention and some of the roots of I guess, what we'd call Trumpism right now?
Well, I've seen it throughout my whole career. The first, as a grown-up, the first political campaign I really covered was Ronald Reagan in 1980. I covered him in the general election, and then I covered 6 years of him in the White House. And you absolutely could see the ideological strains that had really come to not fruition, because he got clobbered, of course, by Lyndon Johnson in the 64 election, but came to prominence in 64 under Goldwater, reach fruition under Ronald Reagan. I think less, certainly some of it, but less of it now, because I don't think of Trump as a particularly ideological figure or a particularly conventionally or strictly conservative figure.
Right, but in the anti-elitism, there was a threat of anti-elitism
that ran through
these campaigns. I thought of it when you talked about the shaking of the anchor booth, because there's a lot of anger directed on the part of Trump supporters at the news media right
Absolutely.
Now.
No, and that certainly is a common strain from Goldwater through a lot of Republican and conservative politicians into Trump. Although I will say that your former boss has been known to take a whack or two at the media, particularly Fox News.
Yes, although I can't remember a rally at which Obama supporters rushed the Fox News stanchion or whatever. So it was more civilized, you know.
More civilized demagoguery, perhaps.
We can get to that later.
Okay.
You went on, and at what point did you decide, I'm going to be a reporter, I'm going to be a journalist, I'm going down this road?
Well, not until I was out of college. I actually applied to law school, got into Yale Law School, was about a week away from starting there. I would have been in Hillary Clinton's class. Maybe she would have married me and I would have been president. But I just, less reporting than just not wanting to spend another 3 years in school. And I went around looking for jobs, and this gets back to an earlier point, wanted to start in newspapers, not in TV, because I thought it was better training, better reporting, better writing. I know that's where you started.
Yes.
And got a job at the Boston Globe. And this gets, as I say, back to what we were talking about earlier, was very happy to hear a couple of months later that when I applied and got the job, they had no idea who my dad was. That really pleased me.
Yeah, yeah. What were you covering back in those days?
Within a couple of months was the, and this, talk about a great assignment. I was the City Hall reporter for the Boston Globe, covering Kevin White, who was then the mayor of Boston, and Louise Day Hicks, who was on the city council and one of the champions of the anti-busing movement.
I was a City Hall bureau chief as a young guy at the Tribune, and there is no
better
Chicago
assignment.
City Hall, Boston City Hall. You get a good education there.
Well, then I went to Chicago. My next job,
I remember,
spent 4 years, and then I went to Chicago and worked for WBBM, and I was the political reporter for them and covered the, you know, people talk about Richie Daley. You and I know the mayor, Richard J. Daley, and I covered him for a couple of years.
In the that was a sort of a golden age for WBBM. You must have been there in the Bill and Walter era.
I was. I was there when just
Walter
when they
Jacobson
started.
And Bill Curtis.
Bill Curtis, Walter Jacobson, co-anchors. The sportscaster was Brent Musburger.
Yes.
It was a pretty grand time.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Chris Wallace. What about those Chicago days? You were there for the end of the Daley era, kind of it was beginning to unravel a little bit toward the end of his life. What do you remember about that period of time?
Well, I remember being fortunate and feeling that it was the end of an era. I left before he passed away, but I was there for the trial of Tom Kane,
yes,
who was his top guy
City Hall,
in the City Hall
yeah.
on corruption charges. That's, of course, when then U.S. Prosecutor Jim Thompson, later Governor Thompson, was taking apart the Democratic machine piece by piece. And, you know, you had the sense that it was almost like you were covering a time capsule and that at some point years later you'd be able to say, I covered the Chicago machine of Richard J. Daley. And I do feel that it was just an extraordinary look at a different kind of politics that I don't know that we see today anywhere, where you had this complete commingling of the Cook County Democratic Party and the government of the city of Chicago, where politics was government and government was politics.
You know, and I've talked to the president about this. Chicago politics isn't subtle in Chicago. People are pretty have traditionally been pretty overt about their motivations, and in certain ways, it's politics kind of stripped down to its elemental core. Politics laid bare, and it actually is really good training. You know, Tip O'Neill said all politics is local. You learn a lot, and I don't mean this just in the pejorative way, because these ward committeemen and aldermen, they worked their communities. They knew everybody. They had developed personal relationships, and having to deliver for those people was central to, aside from whatever pecuniary interest they had, was central to what they were doing. I think about those Daley years a lot because I was a young reporter at that time too. When I hear some of Donald Trump's press people trying to explain his tweets and statements, and I was reminded of, I think it was Earl Bush who was his.
Yes,
he went to prison as well.
He was the
press
secretary.
He was the one who said, "Don't print what he says; print what he meant," which was an interesting admonition to reporters. And then you went to network television.
But let me just interrupt to say I completely agree with you. I think that one, it was a fascinating education, and you're exactly right, because these folks were in charge and there was nothing you really could do to them. And so they were often happy to brag about their arrangements. And as far as how it worked for the citizens of Chicago, I'm sure you can get, you know, the Better Government Association in Chicago would tell you about all the terrible things. There are plenty of times as a homeowner here in Washington, D.C., when I wish I had a ward committeeman or a precinct captain who could get my garbage picked up or my street swept, you know, during a big snowstorm. So, there were compensating values.
Well, in many ways, you know, I was one of the young reformers back in the day when I came to Chicago as a college student, and was absolutely convinced that the total democratization of the process was not only necessary but right, and to some extent we achieved that in the Democratic Party in the nominating process of candidates. And there are times when you say, you know, you kind of yearn for the old days. I'm sure I'll get lots of tweets and emails about this, but you know, the party bosses, they often chose people who were corrupt and inadequate, but But they also produced Adlai Stevenson and Paul Douglas and some and people who took governing seriously.
And FDR and a lot of people. You wonder, it's a terrible thing to say about too much democracy can be a bad thing, but sometimes I think it can. And you know, you'd like to have a blend. You certainly don't want to go back to where it's just
right.
six guys in a room who
Warren Harding,
right.
like in the smoke-filled room.
But, you know, some mixture of primaries. And also, I mean, to some degree, maybe the Democrats have it with the superdelegates, which the Republicans didn't this time.
Which, by the way, I mean, is something that there are many people in the Democratic Party who would like to do away with.
Right.
Would like to do away with.
Right.
So,
but the idea that people who have contributed to the party, I don't mean contributed financially, contributed in terms of their efforts, their product, their production, their involvement with the party over years, to have some stake in the process might not be an altogether bad thing.
And people who have some appreciation for governance, you know.
Right.
That's the theory behind the superdelegates. I think the Republicans kind of yearned for superdelegates in the last in this last process. But you went on to the network, and as you mentioned, you covered Reagan. What did you learn covering him? First of all, what kind of figure was he to cover?
Well, I will say the 1980 campaign, and I didn't cover you guys, so this isn't in any way casting aspersions on you or President Obama. But the 1980 campaign was the best campaign I ever covered. It was the best run campaign. It was the most disciplined in terms of having a coherent. I didn't cover the primaries. I covered the general election from Labor Day, in terms of having a coherent message. It did have a message. There was a coherent set of policies that Reagan embodied and was pushing. And you know, you can argue whether they were the right ones or the wrong ones, but it is what he put into effect. Smaller government, lower taxes, less regulation, more robust defense, harder line in terms of Russia and the Cold War, and he brought that to pass. It's an interesting question. What I'm thinking of him as a candidate and then as a president. I always got along just fine with him. You know, he wasn't going to sit there and unburden himself of his deepest, most philosophical.
I don't think he did that with many people.
No, he didn't.
Reserved guy.
Yeah, but he was perfectly pleasant, and he could banter, and he genuinely liked the press and genuinely respected the idea that we had a role to play. In fact, one of the advantages we had, I remember covering the general election, is that this was a guy who had loved for all these years to say what he thought about things, and oftentimes people wouldn't pay as much attention to him, even as governor of California, as he wanted. Well, now here he was with a trail of reporters covering him and asking him questions all the time. And you ask him a question, he'd answer the question, much to the horror of his aides, because he was just used to the idea of wanting to spout off and say what he wanted to say. So he was great copy. And there was also, particularly in the public stage as president, a larger than life quality. And I have to say, as a reporter for NBC, and I like to think I had this skeptical adversarial relationship reporters should have towards presidents. When you were overseas covering Ronald Reagan, and he was on the world stage, whether it was with Gorbachev or with in China with Deng Xiaoping, you felt some pride. He carried himself like a president.
Yes.
And he made you kind of proud, to quote the song, to be an American.
It's interesting. You know, you're right that he implemented many of the things that he ran on, but he also showed a kind of flexibility, a willingness to compromise, an understanding of the process. I mean, he had been governor of California, which is not an easy state to govern, particularly if you're a conservative Republican, for 8 years. And so he came. So, you know, yes, he cut taxes. He also raised taxes. He increased defense spending and talked about the evil empire and ended up as Gorbachev's ally in terms of nuclear proliferation or non-proliferation, and ultimately set the stage for the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So there was a nuance to him. There were nuances to him and his approach to politics that I think aren't as appreciated sometimes when he's lifted up as a kind of conservative icon.
No, absolutely. And he was the first to say it. As you say, he had been the governor of California for 8 years with Democratic majorities in the legislature. And he always used to say, you know, I'd rather have 80% of something than 100% of nothing. And frequently was willing to make compromises that didn't achieve everything he had set out, but achieved a heck of a lot of what he wanted. One of the questions, as you were saying this, I was thinking, and I'm going to, forgive me, throw this back at you as a question.
Yeah.
Reagan was very successful, and to a certain degree he had to, because he, I think, always had Democratic majorities in the House, not in the Senate, at working with Democrats and peeling off Democrats, conservative Democrats, the boll weevil Democrats, from Tip O'Neill, and using them with the Republican minority to pass legislation in the House, over, as I say, over Tip O'Neill. I've often wondered why Barack Obama didn't make more of an effort, particularly in the first year or two, when he did have a tremendous wave of support, and maybe even if he didn't need it, because he had the veto-proof majority the first year and all of that, why he didn't make more of an effort to get Republican support.
Yeah. No, listen, this is a much brooded about subject. I'd say two things. One is, 2009 was significantly different than the America that Ronald Reagan and the Congress that Ronald Reagan confronted. There wasn't a large body of kind of swing. The swing wasn't as great that because of redistricting and the nature of our politics, which is much more polarized. You didn't find these sort of there wasn't that huge body of kind of the Republican equivalent of the boll weevil Democrats. But beyond that, Chris, and I've talked about this a lot, I think that Mitch McConnell and the leadership, but Mitch McConnell in particular, made a judgment, and it was a shrewd judgment. The president talked about this on our podcast, and I agree with him. But McConnell spoke about this openly, that the principal thing that Barack Obama ran on was bringing people together, getting past this partisan gridlock in Congress. And McConnell understood that if there was this this kumbaya moment where Republicans and Democrats came together around anything particularly big, that would cement Obama's popularity and make it very difficult to displace him. I can tell you, I was there when the president spent hours with people, members particularly of the Senate, on various pieces of legislation, and they would say, look, we just, unless you can get 10 of us, we can't do it, because it's, you know, it's basically it's policy. Now, could he have done better, perhaps, at the margins, you know, but this notion that if he just played a little more golf with guys that it would have been better, I don't think it's true.
Here's the only point I would make with regard to this. You know, I know you guys like to point to the McConnell statement, but that wasn't until, as I remember,
January 2010.
Right. So you had a year for that. And during that year, you basically took the stimulus package, which could have been a very bipartisan effort, and told Eric Cantor, look, we won, elections have consequences, you meaning Obama, and also basically turned over the stimulus package to Nancy Pelosi and the committee chairman, who put a lot of pent-up social programs and things that weren't going to particularly stimulate the economy. I think that was a missed opportunity. I think if there had been a much more bipartisan effort, and if it had included more tax cuts, even if it hadn't been
a third of it was tax cuts,
but even if it hadn't been as Democratic, to get buy-in from Democrats, it seems to me, would have been very helpful. And then there's Obamacare, which ended up being a strict party-line vote. And again, I wonder, you know, I don't have to tell you, because you guys were using it as a talking point. A lot of the health care reform started under John Chafee. It was a Republican idea. Yeah. I just can't. Yeah, again, you were there. I wasn't. But as a pretty close observer, it looked to me like you could have done more.
Let me. talk to you about that in a second. But the funny thing about the stimulus is you talk to Democrats, and the criticism that you still hear today is he loaded it up with tax cuts to try and please Republicans when we should have used that money for more infrastructure and so on. So there's argument on both sides. But I do think
they weren't ready anyway.
I do think this. Trust me, if you ride the roads that I ride in rural Michigan, where I have a home, we're ready for infrastructure.
Well, now the Trump infrastructure.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes, we'll see. I hope it comes because my car is getting beaten up.
Yeah,
here.
Mine too, here in D.C.
But on the on the healthcare front, I there were hours, and I remember one senior member of the Senate who had voted for the Chafee plan, sitting in the Oval for 2 hours in the president saying, well, we like agree on like 98% of this. Can't do it because there was enormous pressure not to do it. But here's what I do feel this. We had a supermajority of 60 by at the peak of that period and large majority in the House, and had the ability to pass this, and the president felt it was urgent that we do it because the healthcare system was imploding, healthcare inflation, the rate of uninsured, and he felt that we had to act then. And he did it with Democratic majorities. What I worry about now, and I do think passing a bill of that magnitude on a partisan basis had ramifications in terms of torquing up the partisan zeal on both sides. Now, what concerns me is we have a president who was, you know, Barack Obama won by 7 points in 2008. He swept in large majorities in both chambers of Congress. A significant electoral landslide as well. And yet we still confronted that. Now you have a president who fell 3 million short in the popular vote, won by slim margins in the states that gave him the electoral advantage. And yeah, I had Sean Spicer on this podcast the other day, and he said, and I said, do you govern with humility? It's almost a rhetorical question when you're talking about Donald Trump, but do you govern with humility or do you govern like you have a mandate? He said, no, I think you govern like you have a mandate.
I think you always have to govern like you have a mandate. I mean, George W. Bush did that in 2001. That doesn't mean that you – I mean, look, you
– Then why with an actual huge majority – do you feel Obama shouldn't have moved forward on the health care?
I didn't say he shouldn't move forward in the health care. I'm just saying how he should have done it. Because here's what you've got now is because he did it in a party line vote, because it became such a political issue, now you've got the possibility and that there was no bipartisan buy-in. And it was, you know, for 8 years, it went to the Supreme Court twice. It was always controversial. Now you've got the possibility that it's going to be largely undone. As a political issue, yeah. Which I think is terribly sad, the idea. I mean, look, everybody wants people to have health care, and the idea, you can argue about the effectiveness of Obamacare, but 20 more million more people have health coverage than did before. And that's one of the things that I asked Republicans throughout the whole campaign. It's easy to say repeal, but, you know, what are you going to do for the 20 million people?
Well, beyond the 20 million people, you know, there are other things. The guarantee for pre-existing people with pre-existing
they'll
insurance.
They'll keep that. They'll
But Chris, this is the reason why after 5 years of voting to repeal the law, they don't have a replacement ready to go, because it is the economics of the private insurance industry is such that this is like a brick wall, and if you pull one brick out, the whole wall comes out. And
I promise you, whatever they do, I mean, and there's, I know, and we can get really into the weeds and talk about high risk pools or whatever, but there's no way politically that they, and frankly, in terms of its merits, that they're going to be able to do away with pre-existing conditions.
Yeah, I think that, and I think there are other elements of this. You know
26.
That there was the recent report said that the projected healthcare spending from 2014 through 2019 is going to come in 11% under the original estimate because of delivery reforms within the Affordable Care Act and changes that are being made. I know.
I'm not bashing Obamacare.
I'm saying the way it came into being. All I'm saying is it's going to be harder to, in any responsible way, sort of, the repeal thing is it's a great political bumper sticker, but the implementation of it could create a lot of chaos that will spill on a lot of people. So they would be right to proceed with caution.
I completely agree with you on that, and I think that there's, you know, as President Trump said in a tweet this week, you know, we got to be careful not to let the Democrats off the hook in owning it because
it was never. But with everything with them, no one knows exactly what it means. You know, it's like a fortune cookie thing.
Right, but what I'm saying is you're exactly right. You know, the Republicans, very quickly, if they repeal it, they're going to own it, and if they start taking away the good parts of Obamacare, they're going to pay a huge political price on it.
But my point was that in a much less strong position relative to the country as a whole, if this president is brazen in pursuing goals that don't have majority support in the country, it is going to create a great deal of problems. And, you know, I got asked a question on my way over here by a reporter who said, should Democrats do what Republicans have done, and should they be relentlessly in opposition for the next 4 years? And I said the temptation is there. I think there's a great deal of disconsternation about what McConnell did on the Supreme Court nominee, holding that seat open for a year. When he had Merrick Garland, who was really a consensus choice, well-liked by Republicans as well as Democrats, and should Democrats, you know, Schumer said, maybe we'll just leave it open. My concern is that we go down this road of mutually assured destruction and that all our institutions are going to get degraded, and it's going to be difficult for any president to govern in the future.
I agree with you, but let's flip that around. And I agree. I happen to think the Republicans were wrong not to consider Merrick Garland on the merits. And if it had turned out that he seemed to be as solid a candidate as he
as they
as
thought he was when
be,
they put him on the Court
right.
of Appeals.
Well, yeah, but those are different. And that wouldn't be the first time a Court of Appeals judge didn't make it to the Supreme Court. But I'm saying, you know, I think they should have considered that. On the flip side of that, though, David, I think you'd agree. When Barack Obama came, I think on the first day, a half dozen of his cabinet nominees were approved. And within the first week, almost all of them were approved. And now you've got Democrats talking about long delays in the hearings to confirm them, and that people aren't going to be, he's going to be sitting around Trump around an empty cabinet table till March. I don't think that's good. And that's something that actually the Republicans did pretty well in 2009.
Yeah. They would argue.
I love this ping pong game.
They would argue. Well, we should take a break before I take my next shot. Here.
Okay.
On the point of nominees, you're absolutely right. I don't think that the last thing that anyone should want is Donald Trump sitting in a room alone making all these decisions by himself. But many of these nominees are pretty controversial. A lot is not known about many of them, and so therefore taking some time to – I'm sure that this thing – I think Senator McConnell will insist on expediting these as much as possible. But there are some – Rex Tillerson, I think the resistance is coming as much from Republicans, McCain and Graham, as from Democrats. So it'll be interesting. Let's talk about the news business.
Yes.
Talk about the news business as you found it. In 1980, which is sort of
when I really started in in TV news 1972 or the newspaper 69. It's completely different. It's completely different because it was then a very pyramid-like hierarchy. You know, you worked at a local station or a local newspaper, and then depending which it was, then you moved up to bigger. And in the case of networks, if you went from a local affiliate, I went from WBBM in Chicago to WNBC in New York to then working at a network. And you know, there were just three networks and maybe a half dozen national newspapers. And once you reach them and once you got a good job in one of them, you were at the top of the heap. Well, it's completely different now, particularly, well, on both sides. It's completely different on the newspaper side because newspapers are in real trouble, and obviously a lot of them...
Sadly.
Yeah. Well, listen, I worked at the Boston Globe for 4 years. You worked at the Trib for how many?
For eight.
Yeah. So I mean, I love newspapers, and I still get... my kids think I'm nuts. I get a little bit, a frisson of excitement every morning when I open my front door, go out on my step, and get my newspaper and open it up and read it. And people say, well, gosh, you should, you know, read it online.
Yes, no. We're like from Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah. Well, you have to fight off the velociraptors to get the... to get it. But the television news business, and this is really interesting to me, when, you know, I was the White House correspondent for NBC, other than being maybe the anchor of the NBC Nightly News, that's as good as it got in the television news business. Politics, Fox News got bigger audiences on election night, got bigger audiences for the Republican convention than NBC did. Frankly, whether it's NBC or whether it's Fox or MSNBC or CNN, I don't know how you could understand what was going on in a campaign if you just watch one of the major broadcast networks. You watch a show like Bret Baier's Special Report, 6 o'clock, a full hour on policy and politics, and with in-depth coverage of the campaigns. There's nothing to compare with that on the three broadcast networks.
Let me ask you about the Fox News. You made the move over here in what, early 2000, 2003 or something like that?
Late 2003.
That was a big get for them because you...
Thank you.
You were, I'd say it behind your back. But
that's like my father. My father used to compliment me more behind my back than my face.
But you understand the rap against Fox News, not your, and I would say I went on your show a lot when I was in the White House. I enjoyed it during the campaigns. I enjoyed it. It was always a brisk way to start my Sunday. But I felt like we had fair exchanges. But I mean, you yourself have been critical at times of some of the coverage. I think early in the Obama administration, you said something that probably wasn't greeted well.
No, actually, I was during the campaign when the Pennsylvania primary and the Senator Obama had said something, and I went on Fox and Friends and said, which I felt that they had done, 2 hours of Obama bashing is enough, and they didn't like that. Mm-hmm. And I probably shouldn't have said it on the air. I think I should have and would have said it behind the scenes. Sure, I've been critical of some of the coverage. I'm critical of some of the coverage of the broadcast networks, too. I look at the way that they covered this campaign, the way they've covered other things, some of the stuff during the Obama administration and before. There's a big dividing line at Fox between news and opinion, and there's no question, and nobody is going to say anything different than from 8 o'clock till 11 prime time, when it was O'Reilly and Megan, or now Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity. Those are opinion shows, and they certainly tilt. I think O'Reilly's a little bit more unpredictable, but they tended to slant Republican, slant conservative, but we don't make any
slant Trump in the case of Sean right now.
Yeah, but actually there have been a lot of people on Fox who were very critical of, like Britt Hume and George Will, of Trump during the entire campaign. Charles mm-hmm. Krauthammer, and Krauthammer was, yeah. Steve Hayes was killing all of them about that. But I think you look at most of our coverage during the day, from 9 o'clock through 7 o'clock, it's pretty even-handed. And sometimes, if we err on the side of giving the conservative, not advancing it or pushing it, but presenting the conservative point of view, I think that's a useful antidote to what the broadcast networks do, where sometimes there's only one side to the argument.
So do you think that when you talk about fair and balanced, do you feel like you're balancing off what other networks are doing?
I think we're presenting both sides of the story. No, because I think that implies, well, we're going to slant right because they slant left.
That's exactly what it implies.
Yes. So I'm not inferring that.
You're no, no, no. I'm expressly suggesting.
Well, I don't know. I think on our show, I think we do make. All right. Let me give you an example of fair and balance, and it will go to the debate. When I moderated the third presidential debate, one of my thoughts after the first two debates was that I wanted a fair and balanced debate. Now, what did that mean? Was it right wing? Was it pro-Trump? No, and I don't think anybody thought that. We got tremendous praise from both sides of the aisle and, you know, all kinds of liberal and conservative commentators.
But I think I was one of them.
Okay. They're guilty as charged. But here are some of the subjects that had not even been discussed after 3 hours of debating between Trump and Hillary Clinton, the Supreme Court, the Constitution, abortion, gun rights, immigration. I mean, it was Donald Trump's major issue. It hadn't been discussed in the debates.
Right.
Debt, entitlement, Social Security, all of that.
Right.
So I think that discussing those issues, not to say one side was right and one side was wrong, was a fair and balanced debate.
Yes, it was. And I'm not critiquing you. Okay, nor your performance in the debate, which I thought you did a superb job in that debate. I'm really talking about the coverage stuff. Look, the network, and Roger Ailes is someone I know. We were competitors as consultants. I came to know him in his role. I'm not here to bash Roger, although there are plenty of people who would do that. But, you know, he was a Republican political operative who was brought in to start a network, and he created a brilliant money-making outlet for Fox, but it reflected his worldview, and he attracted a lot of people who shared his worldview. It's a good business model. This leads me to a different question, though, which, you know, you and I, we grew up in a time when with journalism, I think we were raised to believe journalism was a trust, that we had a responsibility. And, you know, when I start off in the business, the editors would, if the business guys set foot in the newsroom, they would be tarred and feathered and thrown out the window.
I remember the Boston Globe, there was an absolute firewall between the business side and the news side. And I can remember that I never met anybody on the business side in 3 years at the Boston Globe.
And one of the reasons I left the newspaper business was because they had a change of management at the Tribune, and it completely changed. And now you have such a competitive environment with the internet and social media, as well as cable, and the competition for eyeballs is so great that I think there's also a competition between this notion of journalism as a trust and journalism as a business. And
Wait a minute. Don't you think that's always existed? I mean, you know, it is called the news business. And I will agree with you that the balance on the seesaw has shifted somewhat. But, you know, I can remember working at the Boston Globe that around Christmas, if there was going to be a story about one of the big advertisers at Christmas, the news side wanted to inform the business side if you were going to tell a story about something that had happened bad at Filene's basement in Boston or something. And
yes.
I'm sure that was true about Marshall Fields in Chicago.
Well, you know, speaking of Marshall Fields, my mother was a journalist, and she was one of the first women in the newsroom at PM. I don't know if you remember. PM was a kind of a left-wing newspaper in New York. But a prominent daily there, and it had no advertising because Marshall Field didn't want advertising to creep into the editorial decision making of those. So what you're saying is true. It seems more pronounced now, and you add to it the sort of instantaneous nature of news. You and I both had this quaint thing, almost as quaint as newspapers themselves, were news cycles.
Right. Right.
Where you could actually reflect on.
A news cycle was 24 hours. And,
right.
You know, winning the news cycle meant winning the day. Now it means winning
the minute.
The minute, the second.
Which doesn't leave a lot for editorial judgment. The other thing that worries me is this whole debate about fact. And are facts fungible? You know, and I wonder what that's going to do to the news business.
Well, I don't think good newsmen think facts are fungible, do you? I mean, I know that there's...
It's a question of what the public... We now have a president who has been, you know, if you were to go on the air and criticize him today for his war with the intel people and suggesting that they're on a political witch hunt, you would probably fetch a tweet saying the phony, crooked media is distorting my words.
First of all, I will. I mean, you know, one of the points I've done, I do local hits. We're doing this on a Friday, and I do local hits with stations around the country. And obviously, everybody's talking about the showdown between the intelligence community, and Trump. And one of the things I've been talking about how is Trump in his tweets talks about the intelligence community and puts intelligence in quotes. You can't have that. You can't have the president denigrating the 17 agencies of patriots who risk their lives in many cases to try to give them the best information to make decisions. The idea, and this is something I've said as well, but this is why you like me, because I don't follow any party line. I think that the embrace of Assange by conservatives has been disgraceful. People forget who this guy was.
Now Republicans, Putin has a 50% approval rating among Republicans because Trump has gone that way. That's kind of astonishing to me.
Well, okay, but there are excesses on.
No, I'm not.
Your
I'm not making a partisan
well.
Point.
It sounded partisan.
the concern I have is that is sort of not just about facts. And, what are fake, we should know what fake news is, a pizza parlor.
Right. This whole idea that Hillary Clinton was involved in that sex trafficking.
Which
ring.
Got millions of.
Well, more than that, it got a guy with a gun.
And the son of the national security nominee of the president circulated it.
But to his credit, was fired as a result.
He was fired. But the notion that if I worry that, and we're all guilty of some of this, that if the news media becomes, and you search for outlets to affirm your point of view rather than inform your point of view, then we're losing something that's fundamental to a democracy.
I agree, David, but here's the whole point of Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch when they started Fox News. They felt that, where everybody just talked about these three objective, nonpartisan networks, that there were millions of people around the country who felt that there was a political slant there that wasn't, that nobody was talking about, that there was an inherent bias in ABC, NBC, and CBS. And one of the reasons that I think you found such a hunger and such an audience for Fox and for conservative talk radio is because people felt that they were only getting a portion of the news and a portion of the news that affirmed rather than inform their point of view. So, there are two sides to that story, and I'm not sure that we aren't sort of past that day, not in the sense of past the day of objectivity, but past the day of thinking that there's any news source out there that everybody's going to trust.
Do you think, and I know we have to wrap, but I wanted to ask you
relative
to this. I know, I could go on for hours, brother, but...
Well, come back. Let's do it again.
Breitbart was considered a kind of a fringe operation for a long time. Now you have the chairman of Breitbart sitting next to the president in the White House, and they will take a prominent place, I assume, in the press room. Does that concern you at all?
Sure. I mean, look, I'm as horrified by some of the Breitbart headlines as you are and as I think any sensible person would be. I'm for all for responsible journalism. It's what my father devoted his life to. It's what I have devoted my life to. I just think that as guilty as you think conservatives are of just wanting people who agree with them, that there are liberals who just want news sources that agree with them.
Yeah, look, I'm worried that we're all headed off in those directions.
But frankly, just one quick example, the New York Times, on the second day, the day after, it would have been Thursday morning. Look at the headline in the New York Times, the Thursday after Election Day, November 10th. And the headline was, Democrat students brace for Trump presidency. I mean, can you imagine a headline if Hillary Clinton had won, Republicans, workers brace for Clinton presidency?
Fair enough, but
it would have happened.
But when we were talking to Sean, Robert Gibbs and I talked with him at a program at the IOP, we said, we were talking about fake news, and he went to some examples like that, and to me,
like
that's
what?
Not fake news. Like, headlines in the Times and he said sometimes, you know, the reporting is wrong or they don't check out their facts thoroughly enough.
To me, that's not fake news.
Right.
In the same sense. I think it's biased news. I think it's irresponsible news, but I don't think it's fake news. Fake news are just concocted news stories which have, you know, aren't biased. They just have no tie connection to reality at all. They're just made up. And that's inexcusable and dangerous. And, you know, the fact that people fall for it, again, as I say, I've devoted my whole life to this, to trying to tell people facts, to try to inform them.
Mm-hmm.
I promise you I'm just as concerned about that as you are.
Well, I'd be a fool not to end it right there. Chris Wallace, thank you for being here. Thank you for coming to the Institute of Politics. We want to have you back again soon.
I would love to do that. I have thoroughly enjoyed this, and at the risk of hurting you, and your credibility, I will say that there was nobody in the Obama White House who treated me more fairly, more openly, in better good nature than you. And it's one of the reasons.
I appreciate. I hope you're not suggesting that sort of in the tallest midget category.
The land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.